the patricians and the plebeians. Very good. Now, this was actually a very diverse group of people. And the great body of it were the peasants. A peasant is not necessarily a poor person. A peasant is someone who owns land, who feeds his family with the produce from the land and sells the rest. What we call a farmer. So they provided the backbone, the peasants did. But then there were also artisans. There were also merchants. There was a difference. There were priests. Priests could come from plebeian or patrician background, but they began to gravitate more and more towards patrician. One thing patricians always need more of is money. And these guys would get richer and richer and richer, but they were never quite allowed into the patrician class. And so eventually a third group came up that were called the equestrian, I guess. Equestrian. Help me, someone.
Equestrian
is I think what I'm looking for. Anybody want to guess why they're called equestrians?
They had horses.
They were rich enough to own horses. Horses were not farm animals. Horses were military animals. Okay? And so what eventually happened is that people, Roman society was very class oriented, but it was not completely static. So people could get wealthy, very, very, very wealthy in the plebeian class. They could gradually move into the equestrian class and then eventually into the patrician class. And there were ways that was allowed to happen. And then often, though, even if they were in the patrician class or the senatorial class is what it kind of got to be known, because you got to go into the Senate and be responsible. Then they had what they called the new people, and they were plebs that were in the Senate. So that's kind of complicated, but if you can kind of remember that there was sort of this moving around, everybody wanted to get to the top of the pile, but it was very slow. Often, generation after generation. If your father could go up one step, then you could go up another step, then your children could go up another step. It was slow. But there was movement, and as you remember, we're looking at long periods of time here. Okay, that was sort of the class organization. At the very bottom of the pile, of course, were slaves, and there were lots of them. I want to talk about slavery in the Roman Empire because it's such an important thing for us to understand. There were also other undesirables, beggars, people who were diseased, criminals. There were gangs in Rome that operate just like gangs do now, with controlling the goods coming in and going out, and mafia type society.
What was the percentage, more or less, of those lowest of the lowest?
So this was considered to be anywhere from 2 to 5%, and sometimes less than that. The very lowest down here, the slaves, I just read that recently, that fluctuated quite a lot, but it could be 20 to 50%.
More than we imagined.
Yeah, quite a lot. Quite a lot of people. Yes.
Wasn't it higher in Rome than in Sorrento, like in the colonies? I'm even wrong about that.
I don't know. I think it fluctuated in the colonies as well. And so to make an ironclad statement, I would want to look at actual data that comes in to see how they established that before I would give my mark of approval to it. But whatever. It was very much a pyramid. All right. Now let's talk about geographical expansion. I made a quote as people were leaving yesterday that the Romans were very proud of the fact that they never fought a war just to expand. They only fought wars to defend themselves. And it's like, really? Are you sure about that? I'm going to give a quote from Edward Gibbons here. I read his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in preparation for this talk. In the concluding chapters of what he wrote, he gave this: "For every war, a motive of safety or revenge, of honor or zeal, of right or convenience may be readily found in the jurisprudence of the conquerors." Catch that? You can always come up with a good reason why you needed to do what you did if you won. And the Romans wanted to make sure that they actually won. Okay. By the way, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire is a bit of a read, but it's great literature. It is the only book of that time that is still read for literature and for history. So it's an amazing classic.
But how many volumes?
Well, it depends which binding you get it in. You can get the unabridged in 3. It's usually in 6. I actually have 2. One's in 8 and one's in 6.
You read it all?
Yes. No, that wasn't. It was in English. that speeds up the process immensely. geographical expansion. Let's talk about how they actually grew, because they were proud of the fact they were not Alexander the Great. They did not go surging through all these other countries and just knock them down like a row of dominoes. I should have a map, and you have maps, but if you want to figure out where Rome is, it's about the middle of the peninsula there. But I'm going to draw kind of a ripple effect. So this is Rome. They finally got a city going. Then there are hundreds of cities all around it. Okay? It's a city-based... It's a rural city, if you want to call it that, where the people are basically rural, but they come into the city for protection. A lot of these they have their own king, and they have their own senate. Okay, so Rome starts making treaties with them, and then they argue, and then they fight. Okay, so the ones closest to Rome were the Latins. These were the people that were established historically, mythically, by the coming of the Trojans. Remember that story that I told? Those were the Latins. Okay? And so one by one, and that's where they came out of. They were Latin to begin with, but Rome was a subdivision within the Latin environment. So these Latin cities, they would make treaties with them. Then they would fight. Then they would make more treaties and so on. What Rome eventually decided as a way of sort of winning this whole thing is that when they make a treaty with a city, that city makes a treaty back with them. So they have two very important things to maintain and control and keep power. That was one of their big things. Don't just get it, keep it. And that is, they make a treaty with us and we uphold our end religiously. We do it. They can depend on that because that makes... what's the word I want?
A
reputation. That reputation goes before me. But there's another word that I want. It's a legal term, but you all know it. Anyway, it's not coming. Yes. What is it? Precedent. There you go. That sets a precedent. They can be trusted. And so they worked at that. The other thing is these cities make a treaty back with Rome, but they are not allowed to make treaties with each other. They may only make it with Rome. So you see, they're the arbitrator of all of this. Okay, so it eventually came that all these people were sort of under Rome's umbrella. Now, Rome, they weren't Roman citizens. They were protected by Rome, and they would help fight Rome's battles, and Rome would protect them. Okay? Eventually then, so you have the Latins, then you have the Etruscans, and then after that you have other people who are on the edge, and especially down south of them were the Samnites, who were much more difficult to manage. There were the Gauls up north, the Celts.
Samnites.
Samnites, all right. The Gauls and the Celts played a special role in their imagination. They were big. They were ugly, uncouth. They didn't fight systematically, but they were wild when they did, and they scared them. They were scared of those Celts. And there was especially one thing that happened. There's a story that up in the south side of the Alps, which they called Cisalpine Gaul, that a bunch of Roman traders met them and gave them some wine to drink to show them what they had to offer. And these guys said, yeah, this is good. Let's go get some more. And went down to Rome to get it. Okay, that's the story that the Romans told, that these people just come and they're barbarians. They were provided a huge thing within their imagination. This became especially evident, and if you look at your timeline, you can see that there was a day that On 390 BC, the sack of Rome by marauding Celts, or Gauls. That was a huge date in the Roman imagination. And Livy tells the story very well of how this built up. But they barely overcame that. It frightened them so badly that these people came down and they actually marched into Rome and destroyed it. And Rome was not really a walled city at that time. It had some protective walls and stuff, but it didn't have the big walls. And that's one of the things they learned then, that the Celts and later the Goths did not know how to conduct a siege. There's a story about how the Goths, as they were wandering through, and these were another group of barbarians several centuries later, they besieged a walled city, and they didn't know what to do, so they spent several days gathering up rocks. All right, when they had big piles of rocks, they threw them at the wall. Then they went away. This is too much. So they made fun. They made fun of these people because they couldn't actually know how to, didn't have that knowledge of how to hold a siege or whatever. So they built walls around Rome after the Celts came through in a marauding mission and killed many people. In fact, they thought about trying to move somewhere else and setting up something else, but they didn't. And then this was Roman kind of innovation coming back. As they recovered, they said, you may build your house, and they had to have special permission to build inside Rome, but everybody may build their house as long as it's done in 1 year. So you can get the idea. The streets just went crazy after that. Everybody was building, rebuilding, and then they worked on walls and things like that. So they reestablished themselves, and then they had... So every time you have a frontier, then the guys next to it, they were the barbarians, and they wouldn't cooperate with their trading and with their economic policies, so then they have to come into treaties, and if they don't want to, then they have to be fought and made to be friends. And so these circles became ever, ever longer, all right? The sphere of influence kept growing. Now, in the middle of all that, back to here, there were great tensions growing between the ruling classes and the lower classes. So the way this was organized is that the ruling classes, they were taught, they went to school, they learned things, and one of them was is how to be a military leader. These people would go, and they were taught how to be a soldier, what we would call a soldier. They didn't. There was a little bit of a different term for them, and how to fight under the orders of these other people. They learned theory. These guys learned practical fighting skills. And it kind of worked, but what they would do is that it was only landed peasants who would be sent in these armies. And the idea was is you're going to fight for your own land, right? So that's why you're invested. People who are just traveling or who are living in there making things like construction workers or merchants or something like that, they could move somewhere else. But the people who own land, now they're invested, so they're the ones who make up the army. That passed into the Founding Fathers' concept when they started the Constitution of the United States. It was only people who owned land who would vote. And it was for exactly that same reason. That was challenged and knocked down. So there was this constant tension. The plebs would go off and fight. They might get killed. They might be too long. They didn't have enough time to get to plant their stuff when they got back, so then they would lose their farms. And then these rich guys would buy it for a song and rent it out, maybe back to them, and they would become kind of serfs. Or they would move back into the city and live as merchants or construction workers or stuff like that. And this gave great, great resentment. Plus, there was great resentment. They had they had laws, but the patricians were the ones in charge of them, and they had a rule that forbade the laws being published. The plebs could not even know what laws they were living under, and so it gave the magistrates great discretion in when to...
Like today.
It actually is worse.
Today is worse?
Yeah, today... No. It was worse then. Eventually, and you will see this in your timeline, there was the law, I think it's 440... The lex conuleia, the equality before the law for both patricians and plebs. All right, and then there was the institution of the censors. The censors were guys that every 5 years they were elected to make sure that everybody was actually fulfilling the office that they were supposed to, and they had the authority to take people out of the Senate And so they were feared, but it was important. Eventually, tribunes were set up who were especially to protect the rights of the plebeian class as well. Eventually, the plebeians could have their own magistrates, and this all grew up. And what the patricians had realized is that same thing what I told you yesterday, that if you overextend, you lose. So they didn't really grant these freedoms very willingly. It was with great argument and tension, but the reason they did is because they're going to lose more if they don't. They began to figure that out. And so that's one of the great geniuses of the Roman imagination, was how to keep this ship afloat. Don't let it tip over, whatever happens. Okay, again, these are extending, and they extended up north and toward what is today Milan, toward the Gauls, and it went south toward the boot heel of Rome. And the southern Italy and Sicily was mostly inhabited by Greeks, and they were under the influence of Carthage. They fought a bunch of battles against King Pyrrhus, who came to help he was a Greek king over in the Greek, what we call Greece today, who came to help his allies in the Italian peninsula. And it's from those wars, there's an H in there. Where is that? Pyrrhic. Against King Pyrrhus, that we get a term called Pyrrhic victory. How many of you have heard that? That term, Pyrrhic victory. All right. It's quite an interesting concept. These people their armies would go out and they would fight and they would lose. So King Pyrrhus was winning. All right. So then they'd come back, they'd raise another army, and they would go fight him again, and King Pyrrhus won again. And they went back and raised another army and came and fought, and he fought and he won again. And then he went home. And they got the land. Mm-hmm. The Pyrrhic victory is a victory that is so expensive that you lose what you're fighting for. All right? That's the concept. And that's where it comes from, are these wars right here. So what this is setting into their imagination is that once we decide to do something, we do it. And if we fail, we try again. And that became a stamp of Roman imagination or identity throughout. It was tremendous resolution, a willingness to take very high losses but still not giving up. And that's one of the things that terrified their enemies, is that they were more concerned about winning than they were about living. And they were willing to give their life for this, to project that kind of an identity. To give an example with these Greek warriors, the way the Greeks fought is that they had long spears, and they might even have more than one, and they would put it down in front of them, and they would push into each other, and then the other army would come and push in against them, and sometimes these spears are like 20 feet long, and so they would be bristling around, and they would get pretty poked up at the beginning, and finally one side would collapse, and then they would run, and the battle was over. All right, people got hurt and killed, but losses were fairly minimal. The Romans came with their short swords, and they would march into that, and they would grab those ends and chop them off, and then go in there hacking with their swords. And people died. They died amazingly fast, amazingly much. And they terrified those guys, with those Greek warriors. And it was like, these people are inhuman. They have only one objective, and that is to win. And so that came deeply, deep within the Roman psyche at a fairly early time.
Violence, you mean?
That commitment to win at any cost.
And true violence,
and definite. It was not always with violence. In fact, they preferred economic ways of doing it as well as open treaties. They would come to their neighbors and say, "All we want is a win-win situation. We want the best for you." and so they would manipulate them as well. But once they fought, once they decided to fight, they were utterly ruthless. Okay. As they got down to the south, and into that boot heel, and there's the Strait of Messina, and there, and then on the other side of Messina is Sicily. This was a problem because Carthage, or that was Carthage's area of influence. Okay, so and again, they started making treaties with the ones on the, let's see here if I can think of this, on the east side of the island, whereas Carthage was primarily interested on the west side of the island. And then the ones on the east side said, oh, these Carthaginians are destroying us with their treaties. Come help us, please. Well, yes, we will help you. This is, again, we come in response to our allies, right? And then here we hit Carthage. All right. So they fought a war with Carthage. Carthage was a sea-going power. They were Phoenicians. They didn't create a great empire in the same way. They had more a network of economic lines, and they didn't bring in other people to be citizens. Let's say that. And this is what I want to say here. Back here, this, as they're expanding, this is a tremendous human toll, right? And so they're eventually realizing that in order to get these guys to win, to fight for us, we have to grant them something that they want. And so finally they started saying them to their Latin allies, listen, come fight for us, and then you will be Roman citizens too. Okay? And that's how the pool would get refilled. And they wanted Roman citizenship very badly. There is a man in the New Testament that specifically is mentioned as being from one of these tribes. He was a centurion. Okay, Cornelius, he was called one of the Italian band. Do you remember that? The Italians are what they call these ones that didn't actually come from the city of Rome, but from originally, but from the allies around them. All right? So they would grant citizenship to these other cities, and then eventually that's how Rome actually gave the idea of the melting pot concept, where you leave an identity and you take on our identity. You become this. And it was a gathering of many different peoples, and then it would come under one umbrella. All right. In doing that, I'll say this too. The concept that slaves, if they are freed, if they are freed by a Roman citizen, then they become Roman citizenship. Roman citizens. They are part of that family. And I should mention this as well. Family was extremely important to the Roman identity. They had several very important families up here in the patrician ones, and then also very notable families in the richer, among the richer plebeian society. These families were critical, and they were also organized as pyramids, right? At the top of the pyramid was the father. The father had the right to decide whether a child lived or not. A child was not actually considered a human being until it was put on his father's knee and named. And so that's how they could expose him. If they didn't, then it wasn't murder. A son, for example, was not allowed to make a will or get married or do any of this stuff without his father's permission, and never allowed to make a will. Only the head of the household was allowed to make a will. And so this trickled down. Now, what is interesting in all of this is Rome did not have a police force. It didn't have this kind of thing that we're used to today. So if you wanted, they did have law, but how do you enforce the law? If you wanted to be heard, you needed a patron. And if you weren't rich enough, then you needed to ask somebody who was richer than you, who was more influential than you. Then they would go talk for you in court, and they would argue amongst these others. And let's say it's a lowly freedman down here. He needed to talk to his patron, who would talk to his patron, who might talk to his patron, if they had a problem with another freedman over here. So this patron would go talk to the patron of the patron of the patron of the patron, who would finally come down here, right, about this situation, and they would resolve it. Now, these guys had armed servants, and if the law went that, yes, this man did wrong, he was, in fact, and there were no prisons, so you were either exiled if you were rich, or you were executed, or you were fined. All right, so this man is supposed to be executed. They didn't necessarily send the police to go do that. These guys' servants would go do it. But they did it with the blessing of the law. And this patron here would send the word down, no, let him do it. He's been found guilty, so don't fight it. All right? So the way people got ahead was by promising service who would then to people who would promise them protection, who would promise service to people who would promise them protection, a little bit like this whole thing in a microscopic way. And these different pyramids would all come to a head at the top, right? And that's how they would raise their armies and things like that. Like the word would go out that, listen, we need 1,000 more people from you. And then he would say, okay, from all of his patrons, I need so many. And then they would say, I need so many. And then they would say, I need so many. And this would all go up to the commander at the top, who was the patrician. All right. Because they raised army after army after army after army. It was phenomenal, the human cost that went into that. Okay. Eventually, though, this war, they focused on Carthage. They won the war after great trouble because they didn't know how to sail, and they had to learn how to do all this, but they did, and got it. So then they charged Carthage an enormous sum of money and said, give us the whole, we now have economic freedom over the whole island of Sicily. You stay out of Sicily, and plus, you pay us for all our expenses. This is important. So Carthage said, oh, well, shoot, I guess we'll have to then, okay. So Carthage says, what can we do? Well, there's this land to the west that supposedly has gold and lead and silver. It's now called Spain. They sent people there, and they started mining in Spain, and they extracted tons and tons and tons of ore, which they used to pay their debt off, and meanwhile got very rich as well. All right, then they're starting to build their ships back up again, and Rome is looking at them, and don't like this. Meanwhile, the Carthaginians were also very stung by the fact that they had lost. And Hannibal's father, of the Barca clan, made him as a child put his hand on an altar and swear that he would always hate the Romans and that he would fight against them whenever he had an opportunity, he would do that. And so that led to the Second Punic War, the war with Carthage, with Hannibal taking the lead, who was a military genius, really the closest one to Alexander the Great that there was. Only also, like the Greeks, they did not know how to turn military victories into political wins. So he was over there fighting, and he tried different ways of, and was superb what he could do on the battlefield, but he couldn't create a country behind him. That was his problem. And they kept regrouping and regrouping and coming after him, and eventually, under Scipio, they won by invading Carthage. And then they took over those mines in Spain. That was a brilliant part. This is now ours, right? And that is when Spain became a Roman province. There's a story that the Spaniards went to the New World and completely emptied it of all of its treasures. It was just trying to make up for what the Romans had done to them earlier. Right? They had taken Spanish silver and gold is spread through the Mediterranean world from those mines. Okay. During that time as well, Julius Caesar was coming to power, and he's the one who brought Gaul under.
We should mention one of the most important changes in this period is that they invented the professional army.
Okay, so all of this was costing too much. And this thing was, people couldn't get back and farm their lands and so on like that. And so Marius said, hey, we need to change. Now, the Romans were very conservative. Conservative is not necessarily a good word. Conservative simply means stay the same. And Romans didn't like things to be different. So to give you an example, the beginning of the year in Rome was March, what we call March, and it is in many calendars. It was in many calendars. Does it make sense? You start with spring, and then it's summer, and then it's fall, and then the end of the year is winter, dead. And then life starts up again. That's the beginning. It's obvious. They knew that the days were getting longer. That's why they called what we call the first month January, which is the beginnings, and then there's February and March, which is war. Now it's spring, it's time to go to work. Time to start fighting our battles. Well, this was a problem because they would elect their leaders, their consuls, in March, but they couldn't get to their theaters of operation in time. By the time they got there, got their troops trained and ready to go again, they had lost too much time. So they said, we're going to change it, and we're going to start all this in January. And that's why January is now considered the first month instead of March. But how many of you know, have thought of what September, October, November, and December mean? 7, 8, 9, and 10. These are months. They kept that. They kept that name. They still call them the seventh month, the eighth month, the ninth month, and the tenth month, which we still do today, even though they were actually the 12th, 11th, 10th, and 9th. Okay? And so they were resisting these changes. But Marius brought reforms to the army, and he said, we need lifelong soldiers. This is their work. They will get paid. And a big problem was is they would go fight these wars and they would lose their land. And so he said, no, that's all changing. They will come fight. They will enlist. They will not be allowed to quit. And then when they leave after their term of service, which was about 25 years for the legionaries, then they will be given land. That will then be theirs. For those who weren't Roman citizens, they could fight in the auxiliaries. And if they did well, they would be then also given a less amount, but something. And their children would be allowed to join the legionaries as citizens. So there was ways of working this all through. And so he created a professional standing army. That's an excellent point.
And I think the two leaders, I just don't want to spend too much time on that. But where they realized that they could win on the Celts or Picts, and later the Germans, their doctors and their generals studied the matter a lot, and they realized that the most efficient way of killing is through piercing and vital organs. So this is what they did with these strong guys during the battle. They were actually only aiming with less effortless almost to pierce them in the spine or in the liver, mm-hmm. and then just leave him like
push them off.
Push them off. They were just piercing like, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 people like these huge guys after they let them battle a little bit, struggle. And they were dying because internal bleeding, and that's why the gladius was thick, a thick sword, and short, just for piercing.
It was a cutting. It could be used to cut, but it was especially a stabbing instrument. Yeah. And also their shields, the way it worked is that they would fight with their right arm and cover their neighbor with their shield. So you depended strongly on the person next to you to defend you while you fought.
And this really gave them morale on the field. I mean, they could kill easily a guy of, 6 feet
tall.
Yeah,
that was much
and
bigger.
And then they trust themselves more and more. This is how they become.
Yes, that's right. So that whole concept of the brotherhood of battle and all of that, they developed that very, very, to a very high degree. So Marius brought in professionalization. That is in your timeline, I think, somewhere.
107.
Okay. It gives you an idea. And what they didn't know then, as they conquered Carthage, and they also had conquered the Greeks in Macedonia to the east, that they were on the verge of terrible stress, because they were starting to raise huge armies to fight these things, and these armies were dedicated to follow their leaders. They were not professional. They didn't go home. They didn't farm their lands and stuff like that. And they swore allegiance to their commanders. All right? Well, then these commanders could turn on each other, right? And that actually happened. So there was a law that no weapon is allowed to be brought into Rome itself, and armies stay away from Rome. Armies are dangerous. Okay? And so after Julius Caesar went to Gaul, and he started using this patronage system, he would raise armies, and he would raise more armies, and he pacified Gaul and his book, The Wars, the Gallic Wars, are very interesting reading, really. By the time he was done, he had 12 units, 12 legions, which was a tremendously powerful force, and these people were used to fighting together. They were veterans. And the Romans themselves were half scared of them. And one thing that you quickly get from reading all this Roman history, they were strong in their sense of being Roman, but they bitterly hated each other. As far, there was nobody that rose high that did not have bitter enemies that wished him the most evil thing that could ever happen, and work very hard to make sure that that would happen. So Julius Caesar had lots of enemies, and he was trying to figure out what to do. And he knew if he just came back to Rome, he was going to be prosecuted. And so that's why he took the fateful step of crossing the Rubicon, which is where his territory ended, and going down where Pompey was supposed to be going up to fight him. But the man couldn't make up his mind and couldn't quite decide where to meet him, and finally ordered the city to be evacuated. And it was a terrible kind of loss, if you want to put it that way. That was through the establishment of the first triumvirate, which was Caesar, Pompey. Can anybody help me? Lepidus. And then shortly after that, Caesar was assassinated because he had made himself dictator for life. That was the regicide law. And then again, Rome broke out into civil war as these massive armies met each other and tried to see who was going to be winning. So they very shortly after that, the Battle of Philippi, these Republicans, the ones who wanted to... They made a terrible mistake, the ones who assassinated him. They just thought if they'd kill him, the problem would go away. No, the problem didn't go away because he had successors. And so then... Those ones supporting the Republic, Brutus and Cato the Elder and some of them, or younger, their army was destroyed and leaving in place a second triumvirate, which was Augustus, Antony, and another guy that hardly matters. it's not coming. Someone say it? That may have been Lepidus, actually.
Say Shakespeare is Julius Caesar.
Yeah. Okay, so that could be the first one or the second one, I guess. At any rate, yes, the first time this story made sense to me as a teenager or even a younger, maybe, I read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and my sympathies were definitely for Julius Caesar. I couldn't believe that they had killed him. Oh, man, I was about weeping and wanting him to be avenged. What's that?
I was on the other side.
You were on the other side. You were on the right side. Antony, eventually, these three fought together, and Augustus came. And he very carefully established the principate, where he is the first citizen, and he is, in a sense, of these pyramids. They had all these different pyramids, and they had been balanced together with one against the other. You know, don't be too strong. Well, he is now at the top of one pyramid, but he is just... He's not necessarily a king. No, that's a bad word. Yeah. He's just there again to lead, guide, and direct in some ways. And the armies are all under his control, and they swear allegiance to him as a person. And that kind of thing. So that is called the Augustinian Revolution, right? Where things changed. The common people would have liked it. Why?
In the security.
They were sick and tired of war. Roman civil wars were extremely bloody and extremely, and they were weary, weary of it. Okay, our time is up. We didn't get to talk about slaves. It gives you an idea. In the time of Augustus, another king was born that would launch a different kind of revolution. Maybe we can talk about that next time.